Good. So I apologize at the beginning for the repetition with respect to other talks and also things that you already know. I will talk about the connection between logic on one hand, or information, and physics on the other. And many people have, of course, already thought about this connection. I have here a quote by Gonzet. He was a mathematician that was then a professor for philosophy at ETH, who said, "La logique est tout d'abord une science naturelle." Logic is, first of all, a natural science. And he influenced with this quote, for example, Spekker, Ernst Spekker, who was a mathematician also at ETH, who was a pupil of Gonzet, who was in a paper in 19, I think it was even 60, then not 61, that is written in German, asking whether it's possible to embed the description of any physical system into classical logic. So the way we speak, our language, propositional logic, for example, is it adequate to describe a system like a quantum mechanical wave function? He had in mind quantum physics when he asked that, but he put it that generally. And he said that the question should be formalized like this: is it possible to extend the description of a quantum mechanical system by adding additional fictional propositions? I will come back to this fiction later, such that in the resulting domain, classical propositional logic governs. So the fiction, of course, is that you also talk about measurement that you don't actually carry out. And he was discussing that a bit later. I come to that back again in the talk. He gave then the answer no. So in that early paper, 1960, that was before Bell or so, he said that there was actually a simple elementary geometric argument that shows that in general, no consistent prophecies are possible concerning the behavior of a quantum mechanical system. He didn't give this argument, and it's not so clear whether at the time he had this argument, because it took 6 years until the argument then really came out. He had a co-author, Simon Cochin, who was his postdoc at the time, and it was a very complicated argument at the time. So I don't go into detail here in this argument. So every point here is a vector. They are connected when they are orthogonal. Today, we know much simpler such arguments that Spekker had in mind to say that quantum mechanics is actually not classical. And actually, the simplest one, the simplest such set of vectors, was drawn in the same year, in 1961, in which Spekker had published his first paper by Escher. So if you take actually this figure here that is in that picture of Escher, and you connect the middle of it with all corners, then you get a set of vectors. I don't draw here all the vectors, that has actually the property Spekker was referring to. And the property is this: you interpret an orthogonal subset of these vectors as a measurement, and then you ask, is it possible that the system is prepared for all these measurements, these possible measurements, in a non-contextual way? That is, if one vector, the green one here is the meaning, is the outcome of the measurement, given that the base, the measurement is carried out in these bases here, then this should also be the outcome in all other bases that contain this vector here. This was called non-contextuality, and one can maybe discuss how natural this condition is. That was the famous Cochin-Spekker theorem. So because such a coloring does not exist, therefore no such preparation exists for the system under all possible measurements. Now, what is actually more striking, we discussed about this non-contextuality condition, it's not so clear how natural. A more striking argument can be actually built directly on this. So let me just continue a bit here by describing a two-party game. So you have two parties who are only allowed to share classical information, but not to talk. And these parties should win a game. And the game is simple. They get from this set here an orthogonal set of vectors, and the output in each case has to be one of these vectors, and the winning condition for the game is that your vectors, they should not be orthogonal. This is a so-called pseudo-telepathy game. And, well, given the Cochin-Spekker theorem that we mentioned, this fact, you immediately have that there cannot be a classical winning strategy for this game that always wins, because this would exactly be such a forbidden coloring of that set of vectors. But on the other hand, if you have a maximally entangled Q-trit pair, then you exactly get this behavior here, and you always win this game. And this, of course, is just a variant of Bell. And all of you have probably already heard of Bell, so I can go over this now very quickly here. The story started in 1935 when, well, in the face of correlations and in the face of the way we usually explain correlations, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen said, well, because the measurement outcomes of entangled states are correlated, they must have been determined already beforehand, not only at the measurement, because this is a natural way to explain the correlations. Until then, 30 years later, Bell said, no, this is not possible. I've modeled it here with playing cards, so you assume that you have pairs of playing cards like before, but each party can decide to look at either the front side or the back side. This was, I guess, Bell's insight, that you really have to look at different measurements, possible measurements that the party can carry out. So if both parties look at the front of the card, they see the same color. Same thing if one looks at the front and the other at the back. And this, of course, implies that if you would both look at the back, you would also see the same colors, but then you see different colors. Now we have a behavior that is not explainable with fixed colorings of the cards. You have to cheat somewhere, for example, here. More precisely, because we have four conditions that contradict each other, you can have this behavior only with probability 3/4 for fixed colored cards. So with classical information, if you have entangled photons, you can get to 85%. That has been called non-locality. So the computer scientist view of this is the PR box. So you have one bit input, which determines which side of the card you want to look at, the choice of your measurement. You get one bit output, this will be the color, and then you have this condition here, the XOR of the output is equal to the end of the input. So you see different colors, if and only if you look at both at the back side of the card. So it looks as if, now because this cannot be explained with fixed colorings of the cards, but still you have correlations, it looks to us as if the cards or the measurement events would talk to each other. Why do we believe that? Well, somehow the belief that is beyond already the reasoning of EPR is Reichenbach's principle, how we usually explain a correlation. This can be either by a common cause in the common past, here we assume that a causal structure is in place initially, or an influence from one event to the other. Now, Bell's theorem, if this is a piece of classical information, Bell's theorem rules out the first option, and there are several problems with the second option. It doesn't seem so natural. It seems an overkill to explain a non-signaling phenomenon with signaling. There are different stories. So there was this famous before-before experiment that registered these correlations even when each particle was measured before the other. That's not exactly supporting an influence explanation of correlations. It's even worse if you go to three parties. There are theoretical arguments based on a property that is like transitivity of non-locality that also works for quantum systems that rules out even finite speed. Hidden influence models for explaining the correlations. Also, it was shown that fine-tuning is required. That is, if you have such an influence explanation and you deviate from the protocol arbitrarily weakly, then immediately you get signaling. Again, this models somehow the intuition that it's an overkill to explain a non-signaling phenomenon with signaling. So if you go back here, and this is now one of the motivations for studying maybe relaxed causality, but if you go back here, the only assumption we have in Reichenbach's principle to start from is this initial causal structure that's given. So how about dropping this? I've heard this quote by Russell, which is more than 100 years ago, so maybe the idea of dropping causality sounds very radical, but maybe it's not that much. In the notion of cause, Russell wrote that the law of causality is a relic of a bygone age, surviving like the monarchy, only because it's erroneously supposed to do no harm. Good, so people did that. Czaslaw, for example, is sitting here. People were relaxing causality. I will not say, more about this here in that talk, because you will hear much more about Emil, about the consequences for communication models, the consequences also for computing. I will just talk about one aspect here, namely that if we drop causality, there's another kind of collateral damage, namely that physically it gets more difficult to define the notion of randomness. What is a random bit physically? Typical definitions, physical definitions of free randomness are based on a causal structure. So this definition here, for example, by Kolbeck and Renner, there are versions of that, but also the other definitions are based on a causal structure. Well, they say that a bit A, given a causal structure, given that you know what is the past and the future, a bit A is free if it's independent, statistically independent, of everything except what is in its future. Of course, a bit that is free can still influence its future, but it should be independent of the rest. one unsatisfactory, not very satisfactory aspect about this definition that is consistent with full determinism, because in full determinism everything is statistically independent. But mainly it assumes this causal structure. So what one could do is one could maybe consider, for example, freeness as more fundamental and see that causal structure is emerging from it, in the sense that if I know that A is free by some reason and then I have a bit that is correlated with it, then it could be regarded as being in its future. But maybe, and for single bits, this is actually all we can do if we don't want to look at the process. But if you have bit strings, then maybe it's easier to find a definition of an intrinsic definition of randomness. So we would like to maybe discuss quickly, is it possible to find maybe a context-independent definition of randomness? Intrinsic maybe then means physically, if we want to quote here Landauer, that information is physical. So for instance, well, in an intrinsic definition, we would not want to call this string random, although, of course, it could come from a sequence of coin flips, but it's not natural to call this string random. Why not? What is a physical reason to why we don't want to call this string random? Well, one physical reason could be this. If you quickly turn to the second law of thermodynamics, well, there were a lot of problems with the second law of thermodynamics. Already Kelvin wrote that you cannot live from dissipation alone, from radiation alone, except if you're a plant. So that it seemed to people realize that there are some life forms that could violate the second law of thermodynamics. Another one was imagined by Maxwell, namely a demon sitting in a gas here by handling a frictionless door, sorting the gas. The solution to that paradox, the solution to that apparent violation of the second law of thermodynamics was found by Bennett, following Landau's information is physical. He said, yeah, we have to look at the brain of this demon. The demon has to sit in the gas and make observations, has to act according to these observations, so therefore he has to have an internal state, remembering what he observed. Or maybe many internal states that are maybe in the state zero initially. And then actually it works. So if you allow the demon not to erase ever any information, but just being in the state zero initially, at the end, this string zero is erased, then this is actually possible and there's no paradox. Well, the paradox disappears because the disorder here created within the demon's brain compensates for the order created outside the demon. But what you see here is that, okay, obviously the zero string has a work value because you can use the zero string to compress the gas. And this is somehow what singles out this zero string, what says that it's okay, maybe not random because it has a work value. But actually, so if you have an other string that maybe looks more random, if I would give this string to you in binary, it would indeed look more random. But if it's the first n position of the binary expansion of pi, well, this is not a random string because there's a short program generating the string, or there is a logically reversible transformation from the pi string to the zero string. And logically reversible transformations can, according to Fredkin and Toffoli, for example, on a billiard table, be carried out thermodynamically neutrally without any energy investment. So this is that this string has exactly the same, essentially the same work value as the zero string. But obviously, most strings, they don't have work value because that would really be a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. So we could maybe take this as an intrinsic randomness notion. But now, what is this demon? How do we have to imagine this demon? Well, I'd like to imagine it constructively as a computation. So this demon here could, for example, be a Turing machine. Maybe this would be natural. So the Turing machine was first proposed by Alan Turing. He wants to understand how a mathematician thinks. And then the idea, what is called the Church-Turing hypothesis, was actually formulated by Kleene first. Namely that, well, this machine can compute actually everything that you can look at as being computable. And Deutsch made this thesis even more a physical thesis, so everything that is physically possible can be simulated on a Turing machine. Deutsch had in mind more a quantum Turing machine here, but if you don't care about efficiency, then this is the same. So it makes sense maybe that this work extraction procedure that we look at here is carried out by a Turing machine. Okay, let's look at it with more detail. So on the string of this Turing machine, the tape of which we have to imagine to be finite, long enough, but finite, because otherwise there would be infinite energy on the tape. So that's the only physically unrealistic aspect of the physical Turing machine model is the infinity of the tape. And now we would like to ask, okay, how much energy can we get out? How much free energy can we get from the environment using this string S here? We want to model, we have a second string here, X, which models some knowledge, a priori knowledge that we could have about the string S, additionally on the tape. But this should not, so the string S can be burned, can disappear, but the string X here is just a catalyst, should remain on the tape unchanged. So the model would be this here. Well, work extraction is in the end then just data compression. So what is the maximal length of a zero string I can extract from S here with a reversible computation using only Toffoli gates, no AND gates, no OR gates? Because only the reversible computation are the ones that I can carry out on a billiard table with elastic collisions, or that I can carry out in generally without heating up the environment. Now, what bounds can we give here? So P, I wrote P here for program, with the idea that, well, if this is really reversible, I can also go back. So P can be used to reconstruct S, at least given X here. So in a sense, I can regard it maybe as a program. And this intuition leads actually to an upper bound on the energy cost, on the energy value, on the energy value of a string. Namely, it's the length of the string minus the Kolmogorov complexity. The Kolmogorov complexity of the string S given X is the length of the shortest program for the Turing machine, that Turing machine we consider here, a fixed universal Turing machine to compute S given X. The choice of the machine is relevant with respect to an additive constant. If you look at the asymptotic model, then the importance of the machine vanishes. So if you go back here, why is that? Well, again, because it must be possible to construct from P and X S. Therefore, P must be at least as long as the shortest program that makes this Turing machine compute S. So we have this bound here. Bennett was actually claiming equality here, but with this constructive view of works and work extraction, I would not agree with that equality here, because the Kolmogorov complexity is not computable. So also the optimal work extraction computation would not be carried out. So I would also say, I will only say here that it's an upper bound. It is, however, tight if this conditional Kolmogorov complexity is essentially zero. Well, if this is zero, it means that you can regard X itself as a program that allows for computing S. And what you can then do is, okay, use this X to indeed compute S. However, you have to make this computation logically reversible. That's what Bennett proposed. You make a history tape. With a history tape, things become logically reversible. But then at the end, you cannot just erase this history tape, but you have to uncompute it. So you do first the computation. This gives you now this string S. You have a second copy of S. That's redundancy. So now you can use the second copy of S to XOR, to reversibly XOR it and compute the zero string here. But that's all reversible, no erasure cost. And now you just uncompute what you computed here. So step by step, you go back all the computation until you get again to the initial state here. And you have generated the work value. So here, in this setting where X somehow means complete knowledge about this string, the work value would be maximal. And this is also in accordance with other, so other researchers have given similar results, but they used entropy measures to model the knowledge of a party, for example, the daemon. And our results are in accordance if this is constructive, in the sense that X is complete knowledge about S, also in the sense that you can compute S from it. If, however, your entropy, your uncertainty about the string is zero because you know that the string is the first n bits of the halting probability of that Turing machine, which is not computable, then according to our results, the work value would actually be zero because you cannot, because the work extraction would not be computable. Good, but we can get a lower bound whenever we can really actually carry out the compression. So if you take a concrete compression algorithm like Lempel-Ziff or any other universal compression algorithm, well, any compression that you can carry out then would immediately lead to a work value of the string. So the lower bound here would be the length minus the any concrete compression that you can actually really compute. Good, so now this problem, I was talking before about Landauer, the problem of work extraction is actually one-to-one related with the problem of erasure cost. And that's how Landauer formulated it. So if you see here, to get rid of bits takes an effort. If you want to erase bits, this costs. This costs free energy that is then dissipated as heat to the environment, again, to compensate for the entropy decrease that you have within your device. So Landauer's principle says, okay, if you want to erase a string S, well, then the work, as Landauer put it, is proportional to the length of that string. But again, here we can now modify this, and we don't have to do a lot because we can now actually, well, the first modification would again be this one here. Well, if the string you want to erase is the first n digits of pi, then it doesn't cost anything because there's this reversible computation from pi to zero. In general, we can say that it is always true that the erasure cost of a string, always given this helper x, plus the work value of a string, will they add up to the length of the string. This follows immediately from the combinations, first extract and then erase, or first erase and then extract, and then you get exactly to these bounds here. So this means that the results we just talked about the work extraction, also give us new bounds on Landauer's principle. So for instance, a lower bound for the erasure cost would be the Kolmogorov complexity. Again, here I consider a model where I have a catalyst X that should remain unchanged on the tape. A lower bound would be given by the Kolmogorov complexity, so kind of the best compression of the string, and an upper bound by the length of a concrete compression that you can actually carry out. And then people have given also the thermodynamic cost of a general computation, not an erasure from S to zero, but what about the general computation from A to B? So there have been, again, by the same authors as before, or an overlapping set, the energy cost for based on entropies. So again, there I would say these are not, in a sense, constructive results. And also there were results by Zurek talking about the cost from A to B, but his results were restricted to deterministic computations where the complexity of B given A is zero, where you got, Zurek actually got here the difference between the two Kolmogorov complexities, but I don't think this in general can be shown to be a lower bound. What can be shown in general to be a lower bound for the cost, the thermodynamic cost, for a computation from A to B, the meaning here is that on the tape there is only A plus zeros, a finite number of zeros, and this catalyst X, and after the computation there's only B on the tape. And however this computation was carried out, there is a minimal cost that was necessary to carry it out, namely the Kolmogorov complexity of A given X minus, and now the length of the best compression of B given X. So this bound can be gotten from the previous year, from the lower bounds and upper bounds on Landauer's principle on the erasure, because, well, one possibility to erase A, of course, is to compute A to B first and then erase B. And that gives you exactly this difference here between the Kolmogorov complexity and the length of a concrete compression. So the better the compression algorithm is that you find for B, the stronger is this lower bound here. Good. So now let me quickly go to talk a bit more about the second law. So we are going to follow in the rest of the talk the idea here that the cost, the erasure cost of a string could be a measure, a physical measure for the randomness of a string. And it's a completely intrinsic measure independent of the process. But how does it come? So how is that related to Landauer's principle? Well, in a sense, one can say that the length of the compression of S is somehow also a measure for the logical irreversibility of this transformation here. And therefore, you have to pay for this transformation a thermodynamical price. But this is kind of a strangely hybrid picture, because we have a logical level, that's all the black level here, where we have an operation that is not logically reversible, and then we have to pay a thermodynamical price in terms of heat that is dissipated. That's somehow strange. So maybe we can somehow make this argument more homogeneous. Let's just quickly try this out. And I would like to try this out by following an anti-Landauer quote. So Landauer said information is physical. just the opposite is it from bit here, considering somehow logic as more fundamental, information is more fundamental. Wheeler said every it, every particle, every field of force, even space-time continuum, derives its function, its meaning, its very existence from bits. So if you follow that, or if you follow also the Church-Turing hypothesis that we saw before, that the physical reality can be considered computed by a Turing machine, well then why not look also at the environment as a computation and try to describe the price that has to be paid as a compensation for the logical irreversibility here in terms of computation instead of heat, temperature, and so on. And then we would get to, well, naturally, seeing this as maybe it's just logical irreversibility because there's no environment of the environment anymore that would compensate for the logical irreversibility. There cannot be any logical irreversibility. So in a closed system, the computation does not have a logical irreversibility. So what you get then, in a sense, is, well, if I consider reality to be a computation by a Turing machine, what property of this computation would the second law of thermodynamics correspond to? The idea would be maybe it's just logical reversibility. What would be consequences of this? So first of all, logical reversibility is meant here not as a symmetric notion. It only means that the future doesn't forget the past. So the future uniquely determines the past. That would be, if this is also true in the other direction, this would be a deterministic computation. But it can also be a probabilistic Turing machine where it's still true that the future doesn't forget the past, but it's now not true that the past determines also uniquely the future. So you can have a quantity here that is essentially non-decreasing. It can decrease a little bit and slowly, just like in the usual formulations of the second law of thermodynamics, you have these exponentially small probabilities to have strange events happening. But this would be now not an entropy depending on the probability, but we would be the Kolmogorov complexity of the content of the tape. You could also get, for example, just quickly to this, versions resembling, for example, Clausius' version of the second law. If you have a string that has a low Hamming weight, kind of a cold string, and a hotter one, then this transformation here would not be logically reversible. You can show this by a counting argument, namely a transformation that makes the cold string even colder and the hot one even hotter, just by a counting argument to see that this is not logically reversible. And the same thing for Kelvin's version. So Kelvin's version of the second law is from one heat bath alone, you cannot get out free energy. Well, you cannot concentrate redundancy into fixed positions. This could be regarded as free work here. This is not logically reversible because you have many more strings on this side here than on that. So this mapping cannot be injective. Good. So let's now pursue in the rest of the talk this idea to see this complexity as a randomness measure. And let's go back to the PR box. So we were talking before about these correlations, and we were talking also about what Specker found strange about all this reasoning. So let's first look at the reasoning that could be seen as a refinement of a theorem by Fine about the randomness of the outputs of a PR box, given that you have non-signaling and given that you have a violation of Bell's inequality, so that you have, for example, this perfect PR box here. So again, this PR box is just characterized by the fact that the outputs are equal if and only if at least one of the inputs was zero. Now, we assume that that's the typical reasoning that was used, for example, in cryptography. That can be used to show that if there were PR boxes, then there could be, cryptography would be, most problems or many problems in cryptography would actually be solved. But then it was actually shown by Barrett, Hardy, and Kent that you can replace the PR box, which does not exist in nature, by singlets that violate the chain Bell inequality, and you can get essentially also the same. So the idea of the reasoning is this. Let's assume that the output bits here are biased. So I assume I have a perfect PR box here, and I assume that given the input pair is 0, 0, this output bit is more likely to be 0 than 1, even only a slight asymmetry we can deny. Good, because of the PR condition, which we assume to hold always, also that bit over there must be biased towards zero because it's the same bit. If I now change this input here, for example, to one, well, non-signaling would then imply that this change should not be detectable on that side, so I would still have to have the same bias there because otherwise I would know that there was a change here. By symmetry, I can I can get exactly the same if the input is 1 here and 0 there. And now again, if I change it here to 1, well, then I still must have the same because I have non-signaling. But now I have a contradiction because now I have two output bits which are both biased towards 0, but now, according to the PR condition, have to be different from each other with probability 1, and this is not possible. So that's the contradiction. So our initial assumption was wrong, that this bit here was only a little bit biased. So the outputs must be perfectly unbiased, given an extremely weak condition only on the randomness of the input bits. Of course, I've used here in my reasoning all four input combinations. But that's a very weak condition that all four input combinations are possible, have non-zero probability. So what you get is really kind of a gold mine in for computer science. It's this randomness generation almost. That's certainly randomness amplification. So under this weak condition on the randomness of the inputs, then you have perfectly random outputs. And again, because randomness from the point of view of an adversary is cryptographic secrecy, you can use this to get cryptographic secrecy. Now again, the PR box doesn't exist, so you have to do it a bit differently to get device independent or post, in a sense, a post. It used to be called post-quantum cryptography, but now post-quantum cryptography is reserved for something different, namely lattice-based cryptosystem resisting quantum computers. But it is somehow post-quantum cryptography here in the sense that you don't have to assume the adversary to be limited by quantum theory. Well, you can get this through the protocol by Barrett, Hardy, and Kent, or also through other protocols people have shown using not perfect PR boxes, but quantum approximations of the PR boxes. You repeat the experiment many times, essentially, and compute the XOR, and you get a secret. So again, this is really very interesting for information theorists, for cryptographers, and so on. But now maybe one or two things are a bit strange. So what is, first of all, somehow it has become a bit circular because we use non-locality to argue that we don't know exactly how to physically define randomness. But now I use here the PR box together with this randomness. But how is it exactly defined? Can we maybe replace it by complexity? And there's a second point that is strange, and now I would like to come back to the fiction as Spekka put it. So Spekka wrote in his paper in 1960 that these investigations there around the Cochen-Spekker theorem, but it applies also to Bell, this is related, all this stuff, he said, to the scholastic speculations. So he talks about medieval Spanish philosophy and that this appears there, the infuturabili. That is the question whether divine omniscience extends to what would have happened if something had happened that did not happen. What he means, of course, is what to talk about measurements I have not carried out. So does it make sense to talk about the result of a measurement that I've not actually carried out? Because, well, Spekka argues here that prophecy is impossible. But of course, if we would, and he says that the argument is that the prophet cannot know for all the possible measurements what are the outcomes. Within the prophecies of the prophet, you can find contradictions. But of course, the argument doesn't work anymore if the prophet also knows what experiment's going to be carried out. Good, but in any case, here we talk about outcomes of measurements. Any Bell inequality does that, talks about outcomes of different measurements that you cannot all carry out at the same time. So is it possible to have, using this randomness measure, this complexity as we talked about, is it possible to use this to find a discussion about PR boxes that does not need that? So now we assume that we have a sequence of experiments that are carried out that give, for simplicity, I assume, again, the PR box correlations. So these are now not choices of inputs, but these are fixed strings now, fixed input strings, AI, BI. I can still call it inputs and outputs, but there's no dynamics in the situation anymore. So I could also leave away the arrows, but I have this condition here. So for all bit position of this quadruple of strings, I have that the XOR of the X and Y strings equals the end of the A and B strings. And now I assume as before, well, before we had a very weak assumption on the randomness of the inputs. Let's take here the strongest possible, just to show a proof of principle that something can be shown. Let's assume that the inputs are incompressible. So what I mean here, again, I assume infinite strings, but I talk about the limits here. So this is the first n bits of A, the first n bits of B, and the Kolmogorov complexity should be essentially 2n of this. This is not only individual incompressibility of the two A and B strings, but it's also joint incompressibility, which is a possibility to define independence without probabilities. It's an independence notion. And if you can define independence, we can also define conditional independence, and that's what non-signaling is, conditional independence. So I can say that the shortest program computing x from A should actually have the same length as the shortest program computing x from A and B. Given A, B should not be of additional help, and that's exactly what non-signaling would mean. Non-signaling doesn't have the dynamic connotation here anymore of choosing a message and signaling to somebody, but still I can just define it formally in the same way. Now let's assume these two assumptions and see what we can say about these four strings. So A and B are assumed to be together incompressible. Now what does this mean about first the string A and B? So that's also an n-bit string. It's the same, it's the bitwise end of the bit positions of A and B. And what I mean here is that this is the Kolmogorov complexity, so the length of the shortest program computing this string A and B from B. This, of course, is not full length. That's what I mean here with the just partially blue, but n half. Well, not full, of course, because if in a given bit position B is zero, then also the end is zero. But it is n half because any further possibility of compression here would also lead to a compression of the pair AB, which we have initially ruled out. So we have this here, and given the PR condition, this also means that the complexities of computing X and Y together added up, given B, cannot be smaller than this n over 2. Because if you have X and Y, you can easily compute A and B. So we have that here. I can also now replace this, write this as a in the following way here, the complexity again of computing Y from B. And I can also, if I want to simplify things, replace here the conditional complexity of X by the unconditional one, because the unconditional one cannot be smaller. So this inequality here is still valid. And now keep in the back of your head, we still have to apply non-signaling. We didn't do it yet. So we could, for example, compare this expression to the Kolmogorov complexity of computing Y given A and B. Well, this is actually the same according to a PR box again. So the XOR of X and Y is A and B. So if you know both A and B, you can compute the string A and B. So computing X and computing Y is exactly the same thing if you have both strings. So this is the same as the complexity of computing X, again, because of the PR box condition. And again, this cannot be bigger than the unconditional complexity of computing X. But now non-signaling comes into play. Non-signaling tells us that this is the same here. So all these inequalities together gives me that the complexity of X grows linearly. So it would be nicer, of course, to show that this is proportional to n, that it's essentially n. This is what we cannot show yet, but at least it is uncomputable. So if X is this infinite string and the program length for the first n bits of n goes to infinity also like this here, it means in particular that this is uncomputable number. It's not a finite length Turing machine. So we get the mechanism now like this. If we have the PR box and we have perfectly incompressible outputs, then at least then the outputs at least are not computable. Good, now again, yes?
I didn't catch that last point. How did you get uncomputability?
Well, uncomputable in the sense that there's not a finite length program computing the infinite string X. So X is imagined to be an infinite string. And what I mean here is that, so this is the theta of the Kolmogorov complexity of the first n bits of X. For a computable number, this doesn't go to infinity linearly, right? Good. Now, PR boxes don't exist in nature, but as Barrett, Hardy, and Kent did, we can also use here the chain-Bell inequality. Exactly the same argument is possible. It gets a bit more complicated, but it is possible, and show that the same mechanism can also be found here. Now you can say, okay, but it's not so surprising that if you give something incompressible here through the measurement settings of, say, a photonic experiment, then that the outputs are uncomputable is not so surprising. Yeah, it's even true given the respective inputs. This was actually also shown in the probabilistic calculus, is also true in the probabilistic calculus, as we saw before, which is important in crypto, for example, because in cryptography, maybe the adversary knows the input to the box, but still the output should be even given that knowledge random. Also here, so the uncomputability of X, for example, can be shown even given A. So the Kolmogorov complexity of X given A grows linearly with the length of the string. So what you get in the end is something like if you have perfectly beyond Turing machine computations that you can strings that you can use as to determine the settings in a Bell experiment, then also the outputs are not computable by a Turing machine. So it gives you some kind of all or nothing feature of the Church-Turing thesis. You would get that if you could show something like there is randomness amplification, as we saw before. What you would need here is Kolmogorov complexity amplification. So it would be much more interesting if we knew that the output here has even higher Kolmogorov complexity than the input. And we are working on that with partners in Montreal. Actually, we have some first results on this, but there's still a lot to be done here to get really to a calculus of complexity amplification based on non-locality, or also then really this all or nothing feature of the Church-Turing hypothesis. Good, how much time do I have? Not much more to say. So I would like to talk about a bit the tension between these thinking styles that we discussed. So in the context, for example, before of the second law of thermodynamics, I have opposed here this it from bit theme with information is physical slogan by Landauer. And I would say, I would like to describe a bit that how I have started to see this a bit in a context, in a philosophical context. I have put some philosophers here that maybe some of you know. So this is Parmenides of Elea. He has been called the ice cold logician. That's why I've put the ice here. That's by Nietzsche, an article about the philosophy in the tragic times of the Greeks. He says that he's an ice cold logician. So for Parmenides, all change was just an illusion. Time was an illusion. Space was an illusion. This is all only subjectively emergent. Whereas his opponent, Heraclitus, said that only change is real. He's most famous for that quote that you cannot step into the same river twice. This is a typical Heraclitian thought. And in a sense, so it has been said, for example, by Jean Hirsch, the philosopher from Geneva, that the whole history of philosophy is coined by this opposition between these two. And in a sense, then, this maybe holds also to some extent for the history of physics. And maybe an early modern version of this conflict can be seen in the conflict between Newton and Leibniz about absolute space-time. So for Newton, I would say the Newtonian absolute space-time is the perfect stage on which this Heraclitian game can happen of all change, whereas for Leibniz, space-time was more relational and even maybe logical, so he did not see that as fundamental. And then again, so the postmodern versions of this could be the Wheeler and Landauer points of view. And physics at the time maybe took more Newton's side. This is, I would put also Einstein on that side, although space-time becomes gets somehow a feedback, but it's still fundamental. There were exceptions. On the other side, maybe Mach. And as I've learned from Bob Cook, when he heard this talk, she said Poincaré, although Poincaré had developed a mathematical theory more or less equivalent to general relativity, he did not believe in absolute space-time. So he said the opposition is actually a German versus French. Good. And maybe even if I can say also this, maybe even the interpretations of quantum theory in a sense can be put into between these traditions of thought. There are more information-based interpretations. There are interpretations that are more based on physical change, like objective physical change. But there are also there's a second dimension here, somehow I would say, maybe between, is classical information in the center of the interpretation, or is it quantum? And let me just quickly say something about this. So this is very personal now, because I did my PhD in classical information theory. I did classical information theory all the time. I knew what a classical bit is, no doubt about that. And then, it's only then, after my PhD, I learned about quantum information and so on. Then maybe I did it for too long, because suddenly I didn't know anymore what a classical bit is. And so what does it mean? At some workshop, I remember, Nicolas Chizin was asked, when is something classical? And he said, when I can publish it. Classical is what I can publish. And he meant it as a joke, but it's not a stupid answer at all, actually. What does it mean? So when is something publishable? When it's copyable, when you can observe it without disturbing it, when it's objective. But maybe there's actually something more to a classical bit. Namely, if you look at the classical bit, we see that it's classical, which would not be true with a spin of which we know that it's either up or down, that we don't see the classicality. But somehow, I would also connect with classicality somehow, maybe some macroscopicity, that you can see that, okay, I look at it and it looks classical. And then becomes a thermodynamic notion. So then one could see classicality as a notion that exists in a thermodynamic limit, and it's related to macroscopicity and redundancy, so to erasure cost. So something that is classical can be easily erased, high work value. So if the all zero string of a big length is a classical string, classical representation of the classical bit zero, but then also the first n digits of pi could be considered a classical object, although it looks more random, but in this sense it will also be classical. Good, but then of course the big puzzle, this brings me back to the beginning of the talk. The big puzzle is, okay, how can it be then, if you do a Bell experiment, that these classical bits that you get in the lab are correlated? Where do these correlations come from? He said that with respect to interpretations of quantum theory, so for nobody, Bell is easy. Bell is a problem in all interpretations of quantum theory. So you have these correlations of classical information. Then the conclusion could be, and I think this is in the spirit of the talk we heard before and we hear after, that, well, maybe this classicality, which is only a thermodynamic limit, and space-time causality arises not before, but only with these pieces of classical information. Good. And allow me a last remark. So what I've shown here are, again, as Jean Hirsch described it, thinking tradition, so schools of thought here. Also, the interpretations of quantum theory are schools. We know there are different schools. And there has been actually a professor at ETH, but he was Austrian, but he was at ETH, who in the 1980s studied as an object of his research traditions of thought. And he was observing fights between scientists, so often one scientist from one style of thought saying that the other one is wrong. But he said, it's not, you cannot do that, because your argument will always only be within your style of thought, and it's not possible to objectively say that something else is wrong. And he said that maybe, actually, and this is maybe a wish, how we could have a discourse in science in general, he said that actually the disagreement is the best somehow way to see how nature really is. And with this hopeful wish, I would like to end my presentation and thank these people here with whom it was a pleasure to talk about all these topics. And I thank you, all of you, for being here and for your attention.
Make a comment that, like, as you started from like this consideration of relationship of physics and logic, and like the last slides were also like more philosophical, I'll say that like Bill Lavier probably would say that like this.
I didn't understand the name.
Bill Lavier, it's the one of the creators of category theory.
Okay.
He would say probably that this relationship between like this fire and ice sides, and also it from bit and the opposite.
Yes.
It probably should be modeled like adjoint factors.
Like adjoint
factors.
Okay.
Categories,
adjoint factors.
Logics.
Okay.
So like, and like, if you think about like having some logical description of like something quantum and like emergent space times, maybe this is also like like whether you go from like matter to information, or like information to matter, maybe like looking this as adjunct factors.
Okay. Did he write about this? I would like to.
I'm refusing myself to write about this. No, he's just like he was just proposing this adjointness as a methodology of thinking about the relationship of various mathematical concepts.
Okay.
And like the idea to like use it to model epistemology or model like theoretical physics things is like something that is still to be done.
Okay, I'd like to read about it. If you could send me maybe this a link or something.
To love you, absolutely.
Yeah, please, yeah.
So I have a question about no-signaling definition. So you have this Kolmogorov complexity of the output, I think it was x conditional a should be equal to the same quantity condition in addition to b.
Right.
Now, when I think about the signaling, it seems to me that it's not, that there is more there, in a sense that I can think about the two strings, bit strings, that have the same complexity, however, they are not the same. So
yes.
If you just pick an example.
But so, what about the conditional complexities?
So what I want to say, if I condition on B and I get a string which is of the same complexity but just bit flipped,
yes,
that would also be a signal.
Yeah. No.
Why?
Okay, so first of all, if you start from a distribution, P, X, Y given A, B, that is non-signaling, and you sample, you get typical sequences with probability almost one, you get typical sequence, and they will satisfy this non-signaling condition here. Well, in the limit.
So what I would think, if you signal
but you said if I change all the bits, then it would...
Imagine that my condition on B, I always get, no matter what B choice is, I always get the bit string of the same complexity, but depending on the input of B, I get the bit flipped of the axis.
That's signaling then.
And therefore, not by measuring complexity, I will see that...
That also by measuring complexity, it would be signaling, because if you have, in addition, this information from B, this would help you, of course, then to compress A given X.
I understand.
Yes. So in the end, this definition here is really what you also would get in the lab in the limit if you really carry out, and if the distributions, if the samples come from distributions, if this distribution is non-signaling, then the data would also be non-signaling in this sense.
I was wondering if you could go back to the place in your talk where you found the upper bound for the complexity of the local output
from a,
being n over 4.
Oh, yeah. Here?
Right. So over the next few slides, you talked about some of the consequences of that, but it went by extremely quickly, and this strikes me as sort of the main...
Yeah, it is.
I'm just wondering if you could repeat a few of the things you said following this.
Following this,
yeah. So you were talking about the Clausius form of the second law.
So I was talking
the Sylvan form of the second law.
No, that was before.
Oh, that was before. Maybe that's what I that's what I wanted to hear.
Okay, so I was asking myself, in a Church-Turing view, where I consider reality as being computed by a Turing machine, then physical laws become properties of computations. So the second law of thermodynamics, what property of a computation would it correspond to? When I got to that, it's maybe just logical reversibility of the computation in the sense that no information is erased. But now I'm not sure what you...
Okay, so if you go back, maybe this, that's where you said no information is erased. That's what logical irreversibility means.
Yeah.
Here.
Mm-hmm.
That went by very quickly as well. So... What property of the usual version of second law are you trying to generalize here, just so I can sort of see the analogy?
I'm not sure if I tried to generalize something, but I tried to homogenize the view, I think, here. Because here you have, okay, in these n-bit positions, you have a logical operation going on, and this logical operation is logically irreversible. Information is forgotten. And then, because of this logical irreversibility, you have to have heat dissipation in the environment. So there's like a thermodynamic level and a logical level. And I was just trying to extends the logical reasoning also to the environment. So if I look at the environment not as a heat bath of temperature so and so, but as a computation, then what would be a logical compensation in the environment instead of a thermodynamical compensation in the environment? And then I just look at the whole as one computation, and it would be natural then to see this compensation as the fact that this computation of this string and the environment together is a logically reversible computation. Because now there's no environment of the environment anymore that could compensate for any logical irreversibility happening here.
And then the logical counterpart of hot and cold is...
Well, yeah, okay, that's just a toy example to show somehow how could a Clausius-like law arise. So Clausius says if you have two heat baths, then you don't have spontaneous heat flow from the cold to the hot. And somehow, how can something like that be seen as coming from logical reversibility? There was just this toy example here where now I introduce some kind of asymmetry between zeros and ones. I consider one to be somehow more energy than zero. So this would be a cold string, right, with only little zeros. This is a hotter string. But the map from the set of these strings to the set of such pairs where the differences are even accentuated, even that is, the cold string gets even colder and the hot one gets even hotter, this map cannot be logically reversible because there are just more strings on this side than on that one.
So what's puzzling me is that you made a shift from when you're talking about the second law in the environment. It seemed to me like you're thinking of hot and cold in terms of, for example, erasure cost, the incompressibility. And now we're talking about...
Yeah, it's true that here, yes. There is a shift.
Is there a single notion of...
So before there was a symmetry between 0 and 1, but just for this toy example here, there's kind of an asymmetry. But I mean, okay, as long as I don't say hot and cold, I can still say that there is no asymmetry between 0 and 1. It's just this, that... But if you stick just to this here... It means you have two strings. One is like hemming poor, and the other one is hemming rich. And the map from this to another pair of strings where the poorer gets even poorer and the richer gets even richer, this is not logically reversible because of counting, right? There are more such pairs than such pairs. So the map from this set of these pairs to the set of that pairs cannot be logically reversible, cannot be injective. And now I was connecting this observation the observation would be logical reversibility tends not to accentuate differences, make differences stronger. And that now sounds a bit like Clausius, where you say, okay, if you have a hot and a cold heat bath, you don't have a spontaneous flow. But it's like here, you don't have a spontaneous one flow from the weak hemming string to the high hemming weight string.
So the algorithmic gloss on this would be, if I consider the set of strings of the left type.
It's just bigger.
It's bigger.
And therefore, if you draw the set, it's a bigger set, so the map cannot be injective.
I would imagine that the program that generates this is shorter than the program that generates a more limited set of strings.
The program that generates... Yeah, okay, you could also... Exactly. You could also say that here... Because we have seen before that if you have a computation that is logically reversible, then the Kolmogorov complexity is of the content of the tape is essentially increasing. So here, exactly, you could also formulate it like this. So these strings, they look Kolmogorov lower, Kolmogorov more compressible than the other one. I mean, the of course, this is all discretized here. But the Clausius law, of course, follows, for example, from ergodicity of time evolutions. The volumes don't shrink. And in a sense, this is the continuous version of this more combinatorial, logical reversibility. This discretized version of that.
Really short question. You follow the third law?
No. I know the zeroth one, but no.
Yeah.
that you cannot cool down to zero temperatures and make it really cold.
Okay, Do you think?
No, I was just curious if you've thought already. That we
but I shall do it.
Well, if you have another question, you can chat with someone about it. Sure. Or ask it.
I'll be around for the whole week. I'll be around for the whole week. So
and what we're trying to do, that's the facts about it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.